Yastakur ki jai. Prem chikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopinath Swami Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan ki jai. Vrindavan Dham ki jai. Mathura Dham ki jai. Navadvipa Mayapur Dham ki jai. Gaganath Puri Dham ki jai. Gagamaya Jamuna Devi ki jai. Bhakti Devi ki jai. Tulsi Maharani ki jai. Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vinata Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharni Nivasesa Sanyavani Paskatyati Satani. Mande Ham Sri Guru Sri Utah Padakamam Sri Guru and Vaishnavas Cha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitam Sam Sajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Paditana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Param Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitam Sha. Vanchakapa Chubhishaki Vasnaviva Tapitanam Pavanevio Vaishnavi Mona. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. March 11th, 2015, in Auckland, New Zealand, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 6, Conversation between Narada and Vyasadeva, Text 2. Vyasa Uvacha, Bhikshubhir Vipravasite, Vijnana Deshtabhistava, Vartamano Vyasyadye, Tata Kim Makarod Bhavan.
Tata Kim Makarod Bhavan.
Please chant.
Yasa Uvacha.
Yasa Uvacha.
Vikshubhir Vipravasite.
Vikshubhir Vipravasite.
Vijnana Deshtabhistava.
Vijnana Deshtabhistava.
Vyasa Uvacha.
Sri
Vyasadeva
said,
Bhikshubhihi,
by
the great mendicants,
Vipravasite,
having departed for other places, Vijnana, scientific knowledge and transcendence, Adestrabhihi,
those
who had
instructed,
Tava,
of
yore,
Vartamana,
present, Vyayasi,
of
the duration of life, Adye,
before
the beginning of,
Tata,
after that,
Kim,
what,
Akarot,
did,
Bhavan,
your good self. By the way, Bhavan is a very respectful way of saying you. Just like there are many languages that have different ways to say you. I think in Korean there's 15. Right? In Indonesian, there's also so many different ways to say you. Bhavan is, because we have Tavat here as yours, but Bhavan is very respectful. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sri Vyasadeva said, "What did you, Narada, do after the departure of the great sages who had instructed you in scientific transcendental knowledge before the beginning of your present birth?" So you got the instruction, then what did you do with it? A lot of times people are just anxious to know, you know, okay, what was it like when you met Srila Prabhupada? But they don't usually ask you, what did you do with that? What did you do with the instruction? Purport. Vyasadeva himself was a disciple of Naradaji, and therefore was natural to be anxious to hear what Narada did after initiation from the spiritual masters. He wanted to follow in Narada's footsteps in order to attain to the same perfect stage of life. This desire to inquire from the spiritual master is an essential factor to the progressive path. This process is technically known as sad dharma prachar. So sad means eternal, real, dharma, occupation, religion, essence, and prachar means to inquire. So to inquire after the path, the ultimate path of truth. Vyasa uvacha bhikshubhir vipravasi te vijnana deshtavistata tava vartamano vyasyadye tatakim akarod bhavan. Sri Vyasadeva said, "What did you, Narada, do after the departure of the great sages who had instructed you in scientific transcendental knowledge before the beginning of your present birth?" Interesting that just a little very side note, that it was said that Narada took initiation from the Bhakti Vedantas, plural, and here it says, after initiation from the spiritual masters, plural, which is fascinating because Diksha is only given by one person. So what exactly that means, I do not know. I'm just simply noting it. So here Prabhupada said it is essential. It's an essential factor. So we cannot say that making inquiries is the most important thing. If we're going to talk about the one most important thing in spiritual life, we'd have to pick something else. If we're going to pick the most important thing in spiritual life, what would we pick? We only have a few choices here. Following the orders of a spiritual master, or something about accepting and following a spiritual master, because Rupa Goswami gives the three most essential items of devotional service are to take shelter of a spiritual master, take initiation, and follow the instructions. So that would be, you know, most important, one could say. What would be another most important?
Following the
instructions. Yeah, following the, so guru, having a guru, taking initiation from a guru, following the guru, those would be one of them. We could, let's put that as one thing. Your sadhana? Oh, Prabhuji, that's way too big. I said, what's the most important thing? And you say everything. Sadhana means all the 64 items of devotional service. So you picked all of them. They're all the most important. good try. Okay, chanting. So japa, kirtan. So we could say the most important thing is chanting. Harinama, 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 evakeva. Kaloa nasteva, 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 bhaktiranita. I'm just remembering when I was visiting Bhaktivedanta Manor, they had put that verse in a big banner over the altar. And when you'd walk into the temple room, if you were a native English speaker who didn't have much contact with the culture of Krishna consciousness or with Sanskrit, it looked like it said nasty Eva, nasty Eva, nasty Eva over the altar. It was kind of like, I said, you know, maybe you want to take that down. Not quite what you want to be saying to your guests. But with Mahaprabhu was saying that this is the only way. There's no other way. There's no other way. There's no other way. That it's the most essential process is the chanting, and by the chanting, one does all other processes. What else could we say is the most important? Yes? Association with devotees. You could say everything else, and it says, sadhu sangha, sadhu sangha, sarva shastra koi, lava matra sadhu sangha, sarva siddhi hoi. So all perfections come from an 11th of second association with a sadhu. So we could say most important is guru, we could say most important is chanting, we could say most important is Sadhu Sangha. I think there's one other we could really say is the most important, or two more. Two more we could say the most important. Hearing. So there are many, many places where Prabhupada will say that hearing is the most important, that everything is based on hearing. And there's another we could say is the most important, which we were talking about yesterday. What is the definition of bhakti yoga? Mind. It's always thinking of Krishna. So, manmana mabhavan bhakto and maya shaktamana partha. To always think of me, Krishna says, with attachment. That's what Rupa Goswami says is the one rule on which all the other rules are dependent. Always remember Krishna and never forget him. So if we were going to identify, if we were going to pick one thing, okay, we're just going to pick one thing, that this is the most essential thing, it would be guru. Sadhu Sangha, of course, has some relationship between guru and Sadhu Sangha. Hearing, chanting, remembering. We could say, you know, you just do that one thing. But at the same time, this is essential. This asking questions is essential. And I can think of it something like, you could say, you know, well, what's the main ingredient in a cake? It's going to be flour. Without flour, it's not really a cake. It's something else, an imitation cake. Someone just sent me a recipe for flourless brownies made with sweet potatoes, which I think I'm going to try next to Kadasi. But with that, if you don't have flour, it's not really cake, is it? Or bread, you don't have flour. But you could say, in bread, you have to have yeast. It's essential. It's not the most important ingredient, in a sense. It's not the main ingredient. It's not the definition of bread. The definition of bread is not yeast. The definition of bread is flour. But without yeast, you're not going to have any bread. Or like Jesus told his disciples, you are the what of the earth, remember? The salt. He said you are the salt of the earth. Of course, nowadays people have diets without salt. Of course, there's natural salt in food. But Prabhupada says if you want to get rid of a guest, you have an unwanted guest, they're hanging around too long. But you don't want to be rude and just say, get out of here. How do you get rid of your guests? He says the first thing you do is you stop giving them salt. You stop salting their food. So maybe they'll leave. And Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati tells the story that if you want to keep your servants always faithful to you, then you serve them first-class basmati rice with ghee. So this course isn't very culturally specific to Bengal. But in other words, if you want people to stay, you give them something nice. Right? Just like in your Saturday morning program. You want people to come, right? Ready, Katmapu? You want people to come on Saturday morning, and you give them some opulent prasadam that they're going to want to come and eat. Of course, I don't know, with the devotees who live around here, maybe you need to feed them just millet or something, and then they'll come. But the idea is you give somebody nice, then something nice, then they'll come and you take away something. So the salt is considered essential. And in many cultures, if there's no salt in the bread, it's an insult. You're visiting somebody's house, I think like in Turkey, many of the traditional cultures, if you go to somebody's house and they give you food without salt, it's an insult, there could be a war. So you can't say that salt is the food, right? If you're going to be eating cauliflower and potatoes, essential thing is the vegetables. But still, without salt, there's no flavor. So we take this as essential in this way. It's not that asking questions is, you know, the whole core of everything. But still, Prabhupada said it's essential. This desire, he calls it the desire. Not just the asking of questions, but the desire. The desire to inquire from the spiritual master is an essential factor to the progressive path. And of course, Krishna says this, sadvidi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshantite jnanam ganinas tatvadarshina. To ask questions. Just recently, a devotee told me that, one of my godbrothers, she said, was bragging that I have blind faith in my guru. We mentioned this the other day. And I said to her, but it says in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's Prabhupada says in the purport to 434, the main verse about the guru, that blind following is condemned. So it's interesting that often we're proud of our anartis. Have you all noticed that? You know that many times when Krishna reveals in an archa, we realize it's something that we've been feeding and grooming and showing off to other people? Isn't that interesting? This is one of my great qualities. No, it's one of your anartas. So this devotee was very proud that I'm a blind follower, which Prabhupada said is condemned. So then I asked this devotee, what do you think he means by that? And she says, well, I think he means that when he's given an instruction, he doesn't ask any questions. He just goes and does it. But here Srila Prabhupada says that asking questions is an essential factor. One must ask questions. And of course we find the example of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu with... what's the big pastime with asking questions? Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. So the whole pastime is just so humorous. You know, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was probably the most respected senior person in Jagannath Puri. He was the Shastric advisor to the king. He had his own little school, even though he was a Vanaprastha. He was a Kshetra sannyasi. It said that Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya taking Kshetra sannyas, but he was still living with his wife and actually was maintaining his son-in-law. His daughter and son-in-law lived with him and he was maintaining them. I don't know if they lived exactly in the same room, but somehow they lived there and he was maintaining them. Anyway, so he had a little school and he was known as the great scholar. And basically whatever he said was accepted by the general community. So Mahaprabhu was brought to his house after he fainted in front of the Jagannath deity, right? And they weren't sure whether or not he was alive. And then they tested with a little bit of cotton, and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya brought him back to his home and then basically took care of him. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said to him, you shouldn't have taken sannyas so young. And this is frankly our experience in the Hare Krishna movement, that most of the people who took sannyas at a young age weren't able to maintain their sannyas. I think the statistics that I got from Palladananda Swami is 80% of those sannyasis weren't able to maintain their sannyas. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was concerned. You know, like now in ISKCON, I think you have to be at least 45 to take sannyas. He said, you're very young. Not only are you very young, but you're very attractive. I mean, he's God. Right? When Krishna walks down the streets of Mathura, all the ladies, you know, they leave everything. And they're running to the balconies to see him. They're so attracted. Right? These are married ladies. They're not usually running to see some man. Right? But they're so attracted. They're just leaving their bath half finished. They're running away from feeding their husband, whatever, you know. And they're just running to the balcony to see Krishna because he's so attractive. Kandarpa koti kamaniya visesha sopam. Millions and millions of cupids, they're attracted just to the Lord's effulgence. Madan Mohan, the Lord is attracting the most attractive. So how attractive is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? He's very attractive. He's often described like that, as being like Cupid. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was worried. He said, you know, all the women are going to be after you. And you've given up your wife, and you're trying to take sannyas, and you're not going to be able to do it. And he said, actually, he also talked to his brother-in-law, Gopinath Acharya, and he said, you know, Mahaprabhu is not initiated in the right sampradaya. He's initiated in the Bharati Sampradaya. And this also is something I've never understood, something like here with the plural of spiritual masters, where Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, I can reinitiate him into a higher Sampradaya as a sannyasi, which was interesting because Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was, of course, a Kshetra sannyasi, but he was more like what we think of as a Vanaprastha, who was living with his wife. But he was saying that he could reinitiate Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu into a higher sannyas order, and I've never heard anybody explain that. So he was taking this very parental mood towards Lord Chaitanya. You know, he's saying, I could become his guru, I can help him. And he said, well, at least, the very least I could do is make sure that he really knows Vedanta philosophy. Because this is the way that the jnanis try to become liberated. It's through philosophy, through intellectual understanding. That's what Gyan Yoga is. Gyan Yoga is, I'm going to become liberated through philosophical detachment. And sometimes devotees make the mistake of thinking that that's our main process of bhakti, that they start mixing Gyan Mishra Bhakti. And they start thinking, you know, the main way to become Krishna consciousness is detachment. Whereas actually Rupa Goswami says the perfect candidate for Krishna consciousness is neither too detached nor too attached. It's interesting how Prabhupada translates that in the Nectar of Devotion. But the Gyan Yogis, they're just into detachment, and they want to be detached through thoughtfulness. You know, if you really think about it, if you really think about the material world, you'll start becoming detached from it. Isn't that correct? You know, like you're combing your hair in the morning, beautiful hair. Or I was in an airport once with some devotees waiting for a flight. And you know how they have screens in the airports with they're showing different things. So they were showing an advertisement for shampoo. And they were showing this girl with this absolutely gorgeous hair. You know, thick, shiny. And she was swinging her head around like this. Who cares? And all the men that were waiting with us, they all looked down at the ground. But I thought if there was a bunch of hair on the ground, nobody would be attracted, right? You know, this woman with the beautiful hair, she cut off her hair, and there's just a pile of hair. People would be disgusted, get that hair. It's one of the hellish planets. You go swimming in a river of, you know, blood and mucus and hair. And nobody's agitated, nobody's attracted, nobody's lusty swimming in this river. So there's this philosophical detachment. This is detachment through thoughtfulness. Yeah. That one just thinks about what is the nature of this world, and you become detached. So this was Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's process. Of course, it's not just thinking through logic, but it's also through study of the Shastra. Prabhupada will often call it mental speculation, but Jnana Yoga also involves studying the Shastra. What does the Shastra say about the nature of this world? Bhutva, bhutva, praliyate, it's all going to be destroyed. Right? And you become very detached like that. I mean, another example we can give, it's a true story, that some British tourist was traveling in India, I think she was at Rishikesh, and she was saying to one yogi there, how can you live so simply, you don't even have any furniture? And he said, well, where's your furniture? And she said, but I'm just visiting. He said, well, so am I. So this is the general mood of the jnani. Is I'm going to get liberated by detachment, specifically through studying the Shastra. And of course, we have big chunks of the Shastra that focus on detachment, right? The forest of material enjoyment, the Paranjana story, are all like this. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, look, the way you're going to keep your sannyas, which was not Mahaprabhu's idea of sannyas, by the way, but he said, the way you're going to keep your sannyas is you're going to study the Vedanta, and naturally I, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, as the main scholar of Vedanta, I'm going to be the one who will teach you. And I will give you detachment. That was his mood. But it was loving, because it was parental. You understand? So there was gyan, and there was some pride, and there was some, but there was also some feeling of parental rasa toward Mahaprabhu. There was a feeling of care. There was a feeling of concern. There was, you know, something there. So Mahaprabhu said, okay, fine. So he accepted. This is the kindness of Krishna. That he accepts, you know, a little putana comes to kill him, but because she gives him her bodily milk, he says, okay, I accept that. And we'll purify all the other things. Isn't that encouraging? Because often we look at I'm sure none of you, but at least I look at myself and I say, you know, I have like maybe a little something somewhere of bhakti. Sanatana Goswami says he doesn't have even a sesame seed's worth of bhakti. So, you know, I can't even find, you know, where's the bhakti in there? And there's all this other stuff. Maybe if Krishna accepted putana, and then he'll accept me. So Mahaprabhu was accepting Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's mood of service, and he just sat there. It's also interesting that when Sarvabhauma instructed Mahaprabhu, that he had Mahaprabhu sit on a higher seat because he was sent to sannyasi. So even though Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was very elderly, compared to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and a great scholar, he considered that because Mahaprabhu was a sannyasi, he would sit on a higher seat. Interesting. So he's instructing Mahaprabhu for 7 days, and at the end, he says, so, did you understand anything? And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, well, I understand the Vedanta Sutra just perfectly. And then Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, well, but you didn't say anything. He said, I have no idea if you understood or not. Or did you have any questions about anything? Then Mahaprabhu said, well, actually, I understand the verses, but I don't understand your explanations. So, Krishna's really expert. Like Devaraja Swami was saying the other day, that he tells Arjuna, you know, you're speaking very learned words, but actually you're just a fool. So Mahaprabhu says, Same thing to Sarva Bhattacharya. He says, you know, well, the verses make perfect sense to me, but your purports are just, you know, they're really sort of dense. I can't make heads or tails out of what you're trying to say. But Sarva Bhattacharya made the point. He says, it's your duty to ask questions. If there's something you don't understand, if you think that my explanations are wrong or whatever, you know, then you have to ask some questions. So, of course, then there was this discussion where Lord Chaitanya said, well, if you like Sarva Bhattacharya, I could give you my explanations. And then Sarva Bhattacharya surrendered to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He saw that he was the Supreme Lord, and he became the disciple of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So it's also interesting in terms of preaching that sometimes when Prabhupada would preach to somebody, he would first listen to them, even if they were speaking complete nonsense, just so then they would be open to him. And sometimes we go to people and we immediately just want to tell them something without listening to them first. But in any case, the point here is that questions are absolutely essential. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya didn't accept you can't be the student without asking some questions. And we find the whole Shastra with, if there wasn't questions, there wouldn't be a Shastra. It just wouldn't exist. Bhagavad Gita wouldn't exist without questions. Right? It's Arjuna's questions that keep moving everything forward. It's Arjuna's questions that start the whole Bhagavad Gita. And the same with the Bhagavatam. The whole Bhagavatam is just questions and answers. And sometimes, like Sukadeva Goswami, it says that Jiva Goswami says he finished the Bhagavatam in the second canto, I think it's chapter 9, where he says, Pivanti e Bhagavata Atmanasatam, Vrajanti tach charanasharo ruhantikam. Can't remember the last two lines. Anyway, so that verse is said by Jiva Goswami to be the last verse of the Bhagavatam. And then after that, Sukadeva Goswami says, so do you have any more questions? Then Maharaj Prakrit asks a whole bunch of more questions. And then Sukadeva Goswami answers them one after another after another. And inside the answers, like here we have Sukadeva Goswami with the sages of Namasharana, they ask questions. Right? And inside those questions, he finds the answers in the questions of Maharaj Prakrit to Sukadeva Goswami, and then Sukadeva Goswami to answer those questions. He takes another story inside that, right? What questions Vidura asked Maitreya? What questions Devahuti asked Kapila? And so there's layers, huh? Of questions and answers, questions and answers, questions and answers, questions and answers, questions and answers. So if these questions are, they're sort of the essence of all of our shastra, you could say they're a lot of the essence, Prabhupada uses the word essential. They're one of the essences of sadhu sangha. They're one of the essential factors of guru. So we should know something about asking questions, yes? Because at least some of us probably come from cultures where asking questions was frowned upon. I know in a lot of Christian cultures, the idea of asking questions is not very encouraged. We're told just be quiet and have faith. Right? Or even when I was studying religion and I asked some questions of the rabbis and I said, you know, why is Moses arguing with God on Mount Sinai? Why is Moses telling God, you know, you gave a promise to Abraham, you can't kill all these people, and then God says you're right, and how can God say he's wrong and he made a mistake? And how can God change his mind? And how can Moses convince God of something? With an impersonal idea of God, it just didn't make any sense. So I asked the question, and I was told, don't ask these questions. And that was the main reason that I left my parents' religion, and I looked for something else. If he had just said, well, I really don't know, we could try to find out, I wouldn't have had the same response. But when he just said, don't ask this, you know, he responded as if I had done something really heretical and offensive just by asking a question. And many devotees tell stories like this, that they ask their priest or their minister or their rabbi or their imam some question about their religion, and they were confronted, you know, given back this sort of response. Don't ask that question. I mean, I remember even in the Hare Krishna movement, I was in a class, I won't say who was giving the class. Anyway, I was in a class many, 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 many years ago. And this was very soon after Srila Prabhupada left the planet. And I was trying to understand the concept that the relationship with the guru is eternal. And that we're saying, Janme, Janme, Prabhu say. What does this mean? Does this mean I have the same jiva as my guru life after life? Because I was thinking, you know, well, if I were to die now and I were to take birth again in ISKCON, how could I have Prabhupada as my guru? I'd have to have somebody else as my guru. So what does that mean? And the children who were born in the movement, they may have been initiated before. Are they going to have the same person? So I was asking this question. And the person giving class, there was 300 devotees in the temple. And he screamed at me in front of everybody. And he said, "You're asking this question just because you're attached to sense gratification." And I felt like I wanted to kind of go through the floor, you know, and disappear into a hole in the ground somewhere. So sometimes we have some background where we're afraid to ask questions. We see this also in as we travel around the world. There are certain cultures where the children are really discouraged in school from asking questions. Or often we get this idea in school that we should only say something if we have the right answer. You know, don't raise your hand unless you have the right answer. People become afraid of making a mistake or asking a foolish question. I mean, I just had, just when we were in Wellington at the ladies' ashram, there was one of the ladies who said, "You know what, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to ask this question. Maybe it's an offensive question. You know, are you okay?" And then she asked me the question. I don't remember what it was. She asked me the question and then she said, "You know, did I offend you by asking this question?" So if we come from some kind of background like that, where we were trained, you know, don't ask questions. Just do this because I said. Now, of course, when people do that, what impression are they giving? They're giving the impression that they what? That they don't know. Ajahn Dorje Maharaj gives some good advice for preachers. He says, if you don't know, just say, "I don't know." If somebody looks shocked that you don't know, just say, "Well, I mean, by the way, I'm not God. You know, and there's no way that I can know everything. It's not possible." Actually, my husband told me that when he got initiated, he went to meet with Srila Prabhupada later that day. And although he was a brahmachari then, he'd had a job. The temple authorities had asked him to have a job, and he'd saved up some money that he wanted to give Srila Prabhupada. And my husband's always had a great interest in audio. In fact, he started the Bhaktivedanta Tape Ministry. So he said to Srila Prabhupada, "I'd like to buy a tape recorder to travel with you, Srila Prabhupada, to record all of your conversations and your lectures." Frankly, until this time, most of Srila Prabhupada's conversation stuff were not being recorded because there was no tape recorder there. He said, "I'd like to buy you one." He said, "What brand should I buy, Srila Prabhupada?" And Prabhupada said, "That I do not know." And my husband said that as a very new devotee, he had a crisis of faith sitting there in that moment. He doesn't know. How could he not know everything? How could a liberated soul, how could a pure devotee not know what's the best brand of tape recorder to buy? And then, you know, after a few moments, Prabhupada said, "But I heard Tanberg is very good." So my husband bought a Tanberg tape recorder. We don't know everything. Even Narada Muni, who's Sri Kalaja, he doesn't know everything. He asks questions of Brahma. We have also in the Bhagavatam Narada Muni's questions. So if we come from that kind of a place where people who didn't know, instead of saying, "I don't know, I'm not God," shamed us or humiliated us in some way or punished us for asking questions simply because they didn't know the answer, then we may bring that into Krishna consciousness and be afraid to ask questions. But here, because Prabhupada says it's an essential factor to the spiritual path, it seems like it might be a good idea for us to study the science of asking questions. Because Prabhupada, not only does he say that blind following is condemned, what does he also say is condemned? Blind leading? Well, certainly. But not in that purport. In the purport to 434 in the Bhagavad Gita. Yes? In that particular sentence, though, because this is having with the prashnina, asking questions, so he says absurd inquiries, which I'm assuming would include challenging. So he says absurd inquiries, blind following and absurd inquiries. And I can think of one place where Prabhupada was in, I believe, Japan, and one of the people listening in the class said to Srila Prabhupada, "Have you ever seen the demigods?"
And Prabhupada said, why are you asking this question? What benefit will it give you? He said, if I have seen the demigods, how will it help you? And if I haven't seen the demigods, how will it hurt you? He said, why don't you ask whether or not I've seen Krishna? He said, if you've seen the president, then naturally, you know, it's not necessary you have to see the little clerk in the office. And then there was at least one other time when someone asked a question after Prabhupada's class. It was a good question, but it wasn't related to the class. And Prabhupada didn't like that. He said, please ask questions related to the class. He said, otherwise there'll be no end, that anybody can ask questions. And we find that sometimes people will take the question time at the end of a class as an open opportunity to ask some question they've had for, you know, 10 years about something completely unrelated. And it tends to take everything, you know, on and on and on. And then people start asking about that and everything goes off on a tangent. So let's look at this for a minute, because also not only are... Well, let's look at why we should ask questions and then we'll look at how. So why is it so essential to ask questions? Not just to ask, but Prabhupada says a desire to ask. So in other words, not just mechanically, not just, okay, I'm supposed to ask a question, I'll ask a question, like it's a script. But to have the desire to ask questions. Oh, is life hard? Sometimes we think, if you're a child, life is so simple, right? No anxieties. What is she crying about, a crayon or something? Yeah, I thought that was a good guess. By the way, our lamentations look just as absurd to Krishna and the pure devotees. You know, is this child, the world has ended because her sister's chewed on her crayon. And similarly, our world ends because of this or that little catastrophe in our life. We think it's so major, etc., etc., etc. Those who are on a higher platform, they look and think, it's just a crayon. So why is it so important to ask questions? Any thoughts? Yes. Oh, very nice. So one reason that an eagerness to ask questions is important is because it's part of being humble. Of course, that implies it's not a challenging question, right? So if it's, why are you doing that? That's not going to help us become humble. But if we ask questions really with the desire to know, it admits that we don't know. And therefore, it's a very important feature in humility. That's very nice. I like that. Right? If we never ask any questions, it implies we already know everything. Sometimes are we afraid to ask questions because it will show to everybody that we don't know something? You ever had that experience where you really want to ask something and then you're thinking, oh, if I ask this question, then they'll know I don't already know and I've already been a devotee for 10 years and I really ought to already know this? Especially in a big group, or if it's being recorded. I mean, many times people will come to you after the class and say, oh, I didn't want to ask this question in front of everybody. Humility, all right, it really helps foster. I love practical humility, you know, instead of just the, like, theoretical. But real practical humility is at asking questions. What do they say? Better to ask a question and be a fool for a minute than to not ask a question and be a fool for a lifetime. So, what's another reason why it's so essential to ask questions? Yes, Ruben.
Because so much of, especially the beginning of spiritual life, is based on duty, and Prabhupada said it was a duty of the disciple to ask questions in the spiritual master.
Okay, it's based on duty, and it's a duty to ask questions, but I would still like to know why. Why is that one of our duties?
It's speculation, then, but the process of thinking about, in order to have a question, because a lot of times you don't have a question, which means you got to really think in your mind. It's a duty to ask a question.
You
really have to think, which is causing you to remember Krishna.
Oh, thank you. This is so nice. I love asking questions of the people in the class, because pretty much always devotees come up with things that I couldn't have thought of. And I always feel enriched like that, more like East to Ghosti. So it's a fact. I mean, when I used to teach Bhakti Shastri to secondary school students, I required that every class they come in with at least 3 questions from what they've read. They had to come in with 3 questions. Like you're saying, there's a duty. That you're saying that Bhakti starts with doing things out of duty. Vaidhi Bhakti, Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. That's your duty to ask questions. Well, in order to ask questions, you have to think. Otherwise, it's so easy to just hear and read and, you know, and there's no thinking going on. And without thinking of Krishna, where is the best? So it pushes you to really think about Krishna and really know Krishna if you feel it's my duty to come up with some question. So this is, by the way, when you're training people, if you're a teacher, one of the things that you can do is you can require people to have questions. Not just to answer your questions, but you can require them to come up with their own questions. Many times people ask, how can I study Prabhupada's books? And there's as many ways as there are people. But one of them is certainly coming up with your own questions. Very nice. Okay, some other reasons why it's essential, Prabhupada says here. Yes?
It's kind of related to what Prabhupada said, that it helps you learning and memorizing.
Okay, it helps you to remember. And Srila Prabhupada, you know, we have hearing, chanting, remembering. And Prabhupada will sometimes call this remembering as memorizing. Maybe not all of us like Prahladananda Swami, who's literally memorized every word in the Bhagavad Gita and every word in Krishna book. You can try it sometime when he comes. Say, Maharaj, you know, could I hear chapter, whatever, 4 of the Krishna book? And he'll just tell you the whole Krishna book. But it does help us to remember when we ask questions, doesn't it? Definitely. Some other reason why, yes? Can we put that in the car park? Can we put that point in the, put it off to the side for right now, and hopefully we'll get to that. We have a few more minutes. Yes.
You might have a need to get clarification if you're serious about applying something that you're hearing.
Okay. So if you're really serious about applying what you're hearing, there may be a need for clarification. In fact, there often is a need for clarification. Because many times we even think we know how to apply something and we don't. We apply it wrongly. This happens very frequently. That we'll hear something and we think, oh yeah, I understand it, and we start applying it, and sometimes 5 years later we find that, oh my goodness, I've been applying it wrongly the whole way, the whole time, because I didn't ask any questions. Some other value of asking questions. Yes? Oh, okay, so you may be asking questions for the benefits of others. You may bring up a point, just like at the end of the Rasalila, Maharaj Parikshit says, why did Krishna act in such an immoral way? And the Acharyas describe that Maharaj Parikshit knew that there were jnanis and karmis in the audience, that not everybody was a bhakta. And he knew they had this question in their mind, but they weren't asking it. So he wanted to ask it for them so as to clear their doubt. So we may want to ask a question like that, that we may think that other people may be hesitant to ask. Yes?
I'm trying to think of an example here that I'm materially aware I can relate to, and that is, it probably happens to all of us that we buy some item, maybe some electronic item, and we think, I know how to use this. And we start playing with it, and we can't figure it out. So the only way we can figure it out is we have to go to the manual and read it.
Mm.
And it's laborious, and we don't want to do it. But that tells us exactly how to do it. And it's a little like that in spiritual life.
Yes.
We think we know.
We say, okay, I got it. I understand it, which is very related to what your point was. And without going and asking questions and referring to the manual, you may do it wrong. Right? I mean, I remember when my daughter showed me how to do something with a software program that just was, wow, it makes it so much easier, and I didn't even know it could do that. So to know how to do things in bhakti, to know what the, you know, one has to have a desire, again, a desire to ask questions. All right, how do we ask questions? How, when, and from whom? Well, hopefully from whom, we ask questions of somebody who's likely to know. Now, that may seem like a very obvious thing, but how is it that someone's going to know? How do we choose who's going to know? So it has to be a level of realization and also, my dear friends, experience. It also has to be experience. I find it very interesting when someone asks questions of a person about a subject with which that person has no experience. They've read it in the Shastra, true, but you can read it in the Shastra also. And if the person has no experience with applying that, their ability to answer that question is going to be compromised. And I think we told the story here the other day about Sankaracharya. We tell that story? Did we tell that here? No? How Sankaracharya was debating with a king and a queen? We didn't tell that here?
No.
So Prabhupada describes this in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Sankaracharya was traveling debating, and whoever lost the debate had to become his disciple, which meant taking sannyas. It was a very serious thing. Not like today when people debate anything and they don't even notice who wins and who loses and there's no consequence. You know, so he was debating with this king and the queen was the arbitrator, the queen was the judge. Pretty astonishing that she'd be asked to be the judge with her own husband being involved. And if he lost, he'd have to take sannyas. So she must have been very qualified, both qualified in the Shastra to be able to judge who won and who lost, and qualified in her ability to be neutral. So she says, Sankaracharya, you've won the debate, my husband has lost. She said, but I'm half of his body, you have to debate with me also. So Sankaracharya agreed, he said, yes, that's true. And the debate was open, they could debate on anything from any part of the Vedas. She said, I want to debate on the parts of the Vedas that deal with, the way Prabhupada puts it, the erotic principles. And Sankaracharya said, I can't. He said, I have no experience. He said, I took sannyas when I was 8, and I have no experience. He said, give me a month. So he left. Prabhupada said he went in a cave. He left his body. He asked a disciple to guard his body. He found a king who was dying. He entered that body of the king after the king's soul had left. Prabhupada says for 1 month, the way Prabhupada puts it, he enjoyed the erotic principles in the body of a king. Then after the month, he left the body of a king, went back into his Sankaracharya sannyas body, came out of the cave, came back to the kingdom and says, okay, here I am. He defeated the queen, at which point Prabhupada says she gave up material life. So the point is that as people who know what they're talking about, as people who have experience, if somebody hasn't had experience, you can't ask them. Don't ask them. Please don't ask them. And if they volunteer the information, please just smile. Say thank you and don't give it much attention. You know, many times people are happy to offer advice on matters with which they have zero experience. And you could say, well, if you're a great realized soul, then don't you know about everything? Well, yes, but Sankaracharya is Lord Shiva and still he felt he needed to have experience. So as people who are experienced and realized both, because just experience without realization is useless. So many people have so much experience, but they have no spiritual realization with which to understand and interpret and apply that experience. Yes? It's not that experience is the best teacher, but properly understood experience is the best teacher, just like Prabhupada comments in the story of Daksha, that Daksha told Narada Muni, don't make my sons into sannyasis, because they need to have experience of going through all the ashramas in order to become detached. They have to actually experience family life to become detached from it. And Prabhupada says in the purport, it's not experience, it's mercy that gives you detachment. So just experience isn't enough. So you want to ask people questions pertaining to their own realization and pertaining to their own experience. Like you wouldn't ask, you know, someone who's never done deity worship some question about deity worship, because that's not their experience. So those are the kind of people to ask, and also ask people who have compassion and who care about you, because someone who has knowledge and experience but who is envious, and there are people like that, by the way, who have knowledge and experience, but they're envious, just like Sukracharya. He had a lot of realization. I'm sure he had a lot of spiritual realization also. And he also had a lot of experience, but he wasn't really Bali Maharaj's well-wisher, was he? He was his own well-wisher. He was thinking, if he gives everything to Vishnu, how will I live? And he won't have any money anymore. So we also ask people who genuinely care about us and genuinely care about our benefit that they will give us an answer that will benefit us. Therefore, Prabhupada said the guru should be also a very good friend. This is said in the seventh canto. Once you live at the ashram as a guru, there should be a bond of love. Prabhupada said, why would you put yourself under the control of another person if there's not love? So we ask questions of people who care about us. This was one of the main things that like jumped out at you from being in Prabhupada's presence, was how much he cared. Now, I just got an email from someone I'm trying to encourage in Krishna consciousness, and he says, I don't want to preach to people. All I care about is my own, you know, my own spiritual life. All I want to do is go to the higher planets or go back to Godhead. I don't care about anybody else. If they want to know Krishna, they can find out themselves. Don't ask questions of people like that. Somebody says, I don't really care if you know or not. I don't really care what happens to you. Either they won't answer you, or they may even use their knowledge and their experience to mislead you, to take advantage of you. And then, of course, there's a lot in about the modes of material nature, about time and place. So if you study the modes of material nature in the 17th, 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, you'll notice a lot of what differentiates the mode of passion from the mode of ignorance and the mode of, mostly passion and ignorance, is time and place. Picking the right time and place. A worthy person in the right time and place. So, you know, I was telling my grandson Vikram, don't ask me questions from another room. You know, don't be in your... I got some music playing, you're in another room. Hey, Grandma, what's this all about? So right time and place. Like Prabhupada didn't want questions that were not relevant to the class. That's also a time and place thing. You know, somebody's rushing to meet a plane, you don't ask. Well, I always love the one, I have a short question. Yeah, I get that all the time. And it's not how short your question is, it's how long the answer is likely to be. I had somebody tell me once, I have a short question, and the question was, can you explain the purpose and the principles behind Varnashram? I don't think that's, you know, a short question, it really is it one that has a yes or no answer. So, you know, when someone's running off to catch a plane, you don't ask them, you know, can you please explain the whole philosophy of Varnashram? So time and place, right person, right time, right place. This isn't in response to questions, but it reminds me when Burjan Prabhu was taking photos for Back to Godhead magazine, so he sees Prabhupada taking a load of water and walking off into a field, and he's just following him with the camera, and Prabhupada turns around and he says, not now. Oh, Krishna. So what are the proper times and places? You know, sometimes we think my question is very important, and the kinds of questions, to ask questions that are going to benefit ourselves and benefit the person whom we are asking. This is because asking questions, which nobody mentioned this as a benefit, asking questions is also a loving exchange. A loving exchange means I'm benefiting me and I'm benefiting you. It's like if I give you a gift or I give you prasadam, another thing I can give you are my questions. Have you ever thought of it that way? But loving exchanges are giving and taking, right? I'm giving you my questions and you're receiving my questions. So my question should be a gift to you. And we see this in the Shastra that's full of questions where the person being asked will say, thank you for this question. What a wonderful question. Because another reason for questions, even if we already know, is it moves everything forward. Right? Asking questions about Krishna, it brings everything out. Huh? It enlivens everything. It moves the discussion forward and upwards and onwards. So we should ask questions in a way that will benefit ourselves, not asking, well, okay, it's my duty to ask questions, so let me just think of a stupid question. You know, but asking something that will really help us and also that will help the person who's answering. So many times people ask questions and I feel so enlivened in the answer. You know, and I'm sure you all have the experience as preachers that people ask you a question and sometimes you're not sure and then Krishna reveals the answer. You have this experience. And you feel so excited to answer the question. So then just briefly, since you asked that point, we'll talk about answering questions. So answer questions with respect. And if you don't know, say you don't know. Otherwise, sometimes you can damage people's faith, isn't it? I mean, I really feel that many devotees have told me that one of the main reasons they left the religion of their parents was that they got these sort of responses to questions. And I think it's very important in our Hare Krishna society that, you know, anybody should feel free to ask any question about anything. And we might then say to them, look, this is not really, and it, like Prabhupada said, you know, what benefit is there going to be in this question? But we should never shame people for asking questions. And there shouldn't be such a thing as a heretical question. Because if somebody has a doubt, they should be able to express it. I mean, as long as they're not doing it in a challenging, nasty way, if someone sincerely wants to know the answer to something, we should be able to accept that they can ask anything. And in fact, I personally believe that we should encourage this sort of mood where people feel that they have the freedom to ask their deepest, darkest doubts, the things that really bother them, you know, because if you don't clear these doubts, which Prabhupada says are like demons, it's very hard to progress. You know, again, when I taught secondary school students, I encouraged them. I said, come up with as challenging a question as you possibly can. Try to ask me questions I can't answer. And the example that I usually give is when one student asked me, she's a wonderful devotee today, by the way, second initiated and first class devotee. And she said to me, you know, in this purport, Prabhupada's criticizing Arjuna so heavily. Isn't Srila Prabhupada committing Vaishnava aparadha? With how he's talking about Arjuna. So how many devotees would feel safe to ask a question like that? Most of us probably wouldn't, especially in an open gathering like this. You know, we might be thinking it, but we wouldn't ask it. So we really want to have a society where people feel safe to ask these sort of questions, if that's the questions that they have. Otherwise, these things foment in us. So maybe we can meditate on, you know, do I ask questions? Of whom do I ask? When do I ask? Do I ask questions that are really moving my spiritual life forward? Are there some questions I need to ask? Do I have some sort of doubts fomenting inside me that I feel, you know, too ashamed and too prideful to ask anybody? Is there somebody that I can approach? And how do I deal with other people who ask questions? If we believe, as Prabhupada says here, that the desire to inquire for the spiritual master is an essential factor to the progressive path, then certainly we don't want to leave this essential ingredient out of our cooking. So, questions? Yes, Prabhu.
Maybe you can answer from your experience with Prabhupada or other advanced devotees, but Prabhupada says, I can't cite where, but he says that immediately upon speaking, the disciple reveals his entire, you know, state of consciousness and where he is to the spiritual master as soon as he opens his mouth. So that's another reason to ask questions, because you're revealing to the spiritual master and perhaps anybody else who can participate in the assembly what your position is.
Well, here you again show why the desire to ask questions is so essential, because often we don't want to reveal our state of consciousness. But first when you said that, I was like, well, no wonder we don't want to ask questions. But how can somebody help you? We talked about this, I think, yesterday. You can't give someone directions unless you know where they are. How can somebody help you if they don't know your present state of consciousness? Very nice. Yes?
How do I understand, you know, about first-class intelligence and second-class third-class, and this comment you made about making sure the person has experience and you know the first-class intelligence would mean that?
You just learn from hearing. Well, the kind of advice you can give without experience, you can talk about general principles that you can learn from the Shastra, but you cannot give specific advice without experience. When we say that one can learn simply by hearing, what we're talking about that is that you don't have to come to the material world and go through every possible situation. You know, I don't have to become a heroin addict to learn that I don't want to take heroin. You know? And I can say, I've heard from somebody else. That I can say. I can say, you know, I have a godbrother who has struggled with heroin even after becoming a devotee. And I can say, I've heard from him that it's like this. But that's different from hearing from him directly in his personal experience. Frankly, it's different because I have no experience. I've never become addicted to anything. Thank you, Krishna. So I don't really know what it's like. So otherwise, you can talk about principles. I mean, one could, for example, one can understand that I don't need to go through household or life to become detached. One could learn by hearing in that way. But as far as specific instructions, you can't. It doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense. And we've seen damage done by people who speak without experience. A lot of damage done by people who speak without experience. I mean, just like in our school system, we had in the beginning of our movement, we had people running the schools who had no experience with education, no experience with children. And I mean, just let's be totally frank, that's one of the reasons why we had some serious problems, because they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't have any practical experience. I think it was it was in New Zealand at the ladies' retreat years ago, which was one of my most favorite experiences in the Hare Krishna movement. And one of the women came up to me and said, "Urmila, would you give a class on how to be, you know, a lifetime celibate ashram liver?" And I said, "No." I said, "I can't speak on that topic because it's not my experience." I said, "I can speak about renounced life. I've been in a renounced ashram now since 96. But I can't speak about being a lifetime renunciate except in theory. Now, I can say something about it. But if you want me to start giving you practical advice how to do that, I can't do that. That's not reasonable. Or if you wanted to ask my advice on how to run a jewelry business for Krishna, I could give you jen. I could say, you know, yakaroshi yadagnasi yatohosi dai. Give everything to Krishna. Think of Krishna while you're, you know. Think how Krishna's covered with jewels in Dwarka. Think about how Krishna's dancing on the heads of Kaliya and his lotus feet are outshining the jewels. But I can't tell you how to run a jewelry business. Do you follow? I have no experience. So general principles, sure. We can give general principles to anybody. But not specific. What, did you have something? Okay.
This is a question, but it is a question at the same time.
Okay.
My experience is that there's been a lot of censorship in Islam.
You're observing that there's taboos. Every society has taboos. Every society has questions you're not allowed to ask and subjects you're not allowed to talk about. So one of the things I learned in my education studies is that there's four kinds of curriculum. There's the planned or the advertised curriculum, the taught curriculum, the hidden curriculum, and the null curriculum. The planned or the advertised is what you say you teach. What you put in your school brochures or your temple brochures or, you know, whatever, your advertisements, what you have in your planning books. Then there's the taught curriculum, what you actually teach, which is never the same as your planned curriculum and what you say you're going to teach. And by the way, it shouldn't be exactly the same, because when you're in that situation, you should adapt according to the needs of your audience. And the planned is more your ideal. But they're never the same. If you ever think that what someone says they're doing and what they're doing is exactly the same, then you're going to be mistaken. Then there's a hidden curriculum. A hidden curriculum is what you teach through your rules and your norms and how you dress and language. And this is all hidden curriculum. Okay. The kind of pictures you have in your books, how people are portrayed in their books, the rules of etiquette, how people talk to each other. You know, like the GBC's asked the Shastric Advisory Council to do research on how people, what honorifics should be used in addressing women. And you have some people who feel that this is a completely absurd topic. But how we speak to other people means something. Right? And how we speak to each other, the words we call each other, also indicate something of what we believe in. Like, I've been in places where they say, the devotees sit over there and the women sit over there. So that indicates something philosophical, but that's a hidden curriculum. If you said to them, oh, you don't think the women are... No, of course the women are devotees. You know, in the old textbooks in America, all the pictures and the books were all of white, blue-eyed kids who all had Anglo-Saxon names. So if you ask the teachers, are you racist? Oh, of course we're not racist. Do you follow? Or when I was here working on the Learn to Read books and we had all of these, I was reviewing all these books from all these different publishers. So God is just, you know, is presented as just something cultural. That's a hidden curriculum. Or the way they presented animal killing, which just fascinated me. So, of course, there was meat-eating throughout the books, right? If you have books that with meat-eating there, that's a hidden curriculum. But you also had lots of books of predator animals attacking and eating prey animals. And every time the prey animal got away, unless it was an insect. So they didn't mind showing an animal eating an insect, but they would never show an animal eating an animal higher than an insect, never. The sentiments were always with the prey animal. Always, every single time. And I wondered, how is it that these books show meat eating and they also show that our sympathies should be with the prey animal rather than the predator? I thought there's a hidden curriculum here that they're teaching children, you can eat meat and still love animals. You know, they were training them in this sort of cognitive dissonance. So that's a hidden curriculum. Then there's what we call the null curriculum, which is what you're talking about. What's not there? So what was not there in those books was God. He was just absent. He just wasn't there. There was no God in any of the reading series that I looked at from all over the world. There was just no God. There was no religion except as something cultural. It was just absent. There were also no large families, no families with more than three children. That was absent. There were no very rich families. There were no very poor families. There were certain things that just weren't there at all. So the children are growing up thinking that those things are not part of life. When I went to school, nobody in any school, not only did they not talk about God, did they ever talk about UFOs in your schools? They did? I mean, seriously? Actually talk about UFOs? That's very rare. Or like, you know, that there's these places in the world that don't make sense with modern evolutionary theory, like the buildings in South America. In Peru, there's these huge buildings on the mountaintop made with many, many ton rocks that are from a quarry, you know, like 400 kilometers away, up and down the mountains. And even today, we don't have the machinery to move those rocks from the quarry to the building site. And there's only two cranes in the world that could lift rocks that heavy and put them on the building site. And you can't even get a needle or a credit card between the rocks, although there's no mortar. They're cut so close to each other. We have no idea how these were built. None. It would mean that there was a society that was more advanced than we are today, even in gross technology. They don't talk about that in school. It's just not even there. Sariputta calls it the knowledge filter. Oh, this doesn't meet our predominating theory. We just won't talk about it. It just won't be a topic. And when you're brought up thinking that these things are not topics, then you're going to be afraid to talk about them and ask questions about them. What we do by making something in the null curriculum is we make those people who talk about those things outcasts. We make them weird. There's something wrong with them if they talk about it. So every society does this. Every society has a null curriculum, has certain subjects that are taboo, that if you talk about them and if you ask questions about them and if you bring them up, you're all of a sudden on the outside of the society. It is the duty of the brahmanas in ISKCON, specifically the brahmanas in ISKCON, to know all four of these curriculums. But particularly the brahmins need to know, what do we say that we do? What do we actually do? What are we doing in a hidden, subtle way? And what are we doing by not doing it? How are we training people in culture? How are we training people in philosophy and in behavior by what we don't talk about, by what's off of our list? And somebody in the society needs to be looking at those things consciously and deliberately. And if there's something on that null list that doesn't belong there, that's hurting people, then the brahmanas should reintroduce that into society. You follow? We are meant to be, especially the brahmanas in the movement, are meant to be cultural engineers. We are supposed to deliberately have a spiritual culture and deliberately engineer a spiritual culture. And that requires that we have an awareness. We can't expect that every member in the society is going to have that mentality. But at least those who are brahmanas, those who are producing the philosophical papers and the philosophical teaching and guiding the philosophy the society and philosophy and knowledge, need to always be aware, periodically scanning the society and seeing things, what things need to be put on the table and what things need to be put off the table. Like an example of something that we should have in the no curriculum. Srila Prabhupada said, never put pictures in Back to God out of cows being slaughtered. He says that disturbs the whole atmosphere. And he compared it, he said, just like we are against illicit sex, but we do not put pictures of people having illicit sex in Back to God. So in the same way, we don't put pictures of cows being slaughtered. So that needs to be in the no curriculum. And you see devotees will sometimes distribute videos of horrific treatments of animals, but Prabhupada said, no, that is not something that we should be seeing. So that's something that should be in the no curriculum. You follow? And other things that are there, there are some things that are in the no curriculum not because they're really going to disturb people and they're harmful, but they're there because they're embarrassing to our society and we don't have proper answers. And those things had better be taken out of that category and put back into the discussion. And that's the duty of the brahmanas who are supposed to be fearless to do that.
So is there a program for that? I mean, all the brahmanas who are doing that?
You're a brahmana. That was a challenge to you.
Thank you very much.
But if I speak up, then I'll get sensitive.
Well, you have to know. Speaking up, it has to be to whom, when, and where, always. Otherwise, you're in tamagun. So it's still when and where, and if it's a very sensitive, difficult subject, then that becomes even more of a question of when and where and to whom. But still, you are one of the brahmanas in the movement. You specifically are, and that is part of your duty to do that, to make sure that things which have been sidelined for the wrong reasons are brought back onto the table, and things that are on the table that shouldn't be there should be brought off. You know, there's some things that are actually offensive and disturbing, and they really shouldn't be discussed. And we should be able to say to people, sorry, this is not a proper discussion. This is Vaishnava Aparad. Get it off the table. But that is also our duty. But yeah, knowing when and how to do that, and that should be also, if someone's really a brahmana, then that person also should have sattva-gun or bhakti discrimination to know what is binding and what is liberating, what should be done and what should not be done. What will have a good result and what will have a bad result. So that's part of what makes someone a brahmana, is they're in sattva gun or higher in vishuddha sattva, and they have this kind of discretion. So just because you bring something on the table, just like I'm part of an email discussion of devotee scholars, and we discuss in that forum many, many things, certainly, but we certainly discuss subjects that would otherwise be taboo. And we discuss some subjects that we would never, ever, ever discuss in a general gathering, because they would damage people's faith or whatever. I mean, there are certain questions that we bring up about the Shastra, about history, or this or that, that it would be violence to bring up in a general gathering. Yes, please.
Sometimes it's not an experience I've had here, but sometimes a preacher will take the words of Prabhupada, something along the lines of, you know, it's practically impossible to go back to God yet. You know, Prabhupada will make some statement somewhere about something along those lines, and then I'll get like a whole class on it. you're just wasting your time, you know, you're never going to get back, this kind of attitude, and you're kind of sitting there thinking, well, what the hell am I doing here? So, I just walk out of those classes feeling completely deflated. I can't even ask a question.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to ask questions because the person just was so discouraging that you don't even want to ask them a question.
Yeah.
But one of the this five, we'll end with this, there's five austerities of speech. What are they? Should be pleasing. So that's the content should be pleasing. The message should be pleasing. It used to be they would reward messengers of good news and punish messengers of bad news. If we still did that, I think a lot of gossip would stop. So, pleasing message, what else?
Beneficial.
Beneficial. And? Other three?
Truthful.
And? Since all of us talk, it would be a good idea to know this, right? Everybody talks. Not agitating to others, that means pleasant language, not swear words and things like that. What's going on with modern society where people have to swear all the time? What is with that? They always have to agitate you with their language. And regularly reciting the Vedic literature based on the Vedas. So whatever we say should be based on the Vedas. Sadhu Shastra Guru, it should be true, we shouldn't speak lies. And the most important is it should be beneficial. Pleasing and not agitating to others are the least important. You know, if I may have to say, hey, you fool, you're about to fall off the cliff! You know, that may be allowed. That's not a pleasing message and it's agitating language. But beneficial, the main thing is beneficial. So if our preaching doesn't benefit ourselves and the other person, it's not one of the austerities of speech and that's not speech in the mode of goodness. So our question should be, beneficial. The questions we ask should benefit ourselves and others. The answers we give should benefit others. Our preaching should benefit. Everything that we do should be beneficial. And that's a very time and place and circumstance thing. It's a very relationship dependent thing. What I say that may benefit you may harm you, depending on who you are and what our relationship is. Yes? Therefore, it's like an offense to preach the glories of the Lord to the faithless. That's an offense to preach the glories of the Lord? What is that? But if it's to the wrong person, and if preaching the glories of the Lord is going to harm that person, if there's not benefit, then it becomes an offense. So we should be very careful in our questions and answers that there's actual benefit. Thank you very much. Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai.